Welcome to the Idea Pod, a podcast dedicated to exploring and interrogating applied ethics at the University of Leeds.
Hello, and welcome to the Sex Pod, a podcast series exploring the medical, ethical, and philosophical issues surrounding sex work, with a special focus on sex work during the COVID-19 pandemic. This Sex Pod podcast is being produced in collaboration with Idea Pod podcast. Today I've been fortunate enough to have a conversation with two women who work closely with the sex workers in Nottingham. We discuss how the COVID-19 pandemic has impacted the services they provide and explore their views surrounding the legislation currently governing sex work. And I'm really excited to be able to share their invaluable insights with you all. So, I'd firstly like to introduce Jude Green. Jude is the Sexual Health Outreach and Health Promotion Team Lead at Nottingham University Hospitals.
Hi, yes, I work as the Outreach and Health Promotion Lead with Nottingham University Hospital Trust, and our team mainly provide outreach clinical services in the community, mainly to young people but also vulnerable adults. We provide relationship and sex education free of charge, because we're commissioned by Public Health to do that, for anybody working with young people or adults, particularly vulnerable adults within the community.
Thanks so much, Jude. We're also joined by Karis, who works for POW Nottingham, a voluntary organisation supporting sex workers. But I'll let Karis give us a few more details about her role.
Yeah, so I'm the operations manager for POW Nottingham, which is a sex work project in Nottingham that works within the city and the county. We support anyone in the sex work industry, whether that's street sex work, off-street sex work, escorting, stripping, anything to do with the sex work industry, so all strands and platforms. We provide anything from benefit advice and support, kind of debt relief, housing. We have crisis work. We work with migrant sex workers as well. So it's kind of a one-stop shop for the sex workers with things that they might need.
Thank you, Karis. That's really helpful. I was wondering what POW's experience of sex workers contracting the COVID-19 virus has been like, especially as the nature of lots of sex work, I suppose, requires close in-person contact.
We've had no experience at all of people having COVID-19. We've had no sex workers that we work with or anyone really that connected to them disclosing that they've had COVID-19 or suffered any ill health because of it. We've not had any COVID-related deaths or serious illnesses at all.
I was really interested to hear this, especially as Bea Piper, the guest on a previous episode of this podcast and a member of the English Collective of Prostitutes, highlighted the absence of data on COVID-19 rates in the sex working population. In the 2-week period surrounding the recording of this discussion, Nottingham County Council reported that the COVID-19 rate in the general population was almost 1 in 1,000. This made me wonder whether POW's experience of not seeing sex workers physically affected by the COVID-19 virus reflected a true absence of the disease in the sex working population. I wonder whether perhaps sex workers face barriers to presenting to health services, or maybe due to their often hidden existence in society, failed to be included in countywide statistics. I was also interested to explore whether sex workers had felt able to follow the government guidance around social distancing and self-isolation during the pandemic, and put this question to Jude and Karis.
It depends on the platform that you're talking about. So street sex workers, from our experience, nothing changed. Obviously they can't isolate because they're homeless. Mm-hmm. So when the lockdowns were brought in and things like that, I'm not sure what they expected homeless people to do, because there's nowhere for them to lock down into. Off-street sex workers could choose to do that if they wanted to. I think when you're talking about street sex work, sometimes you're talking about surviving, which doesn't really intersect with, you know, government guidance and legislation and things that might be going on topically or politically. So a lot of street sex workers carried on as normal because they had to. I think when you have mandatory lockdowns and things, stay-at-home orders and things like that, and there was some attempt to think about homeless populations, but that tends to be rough sleepers, which tends to be men. There weren't kind of gendered provisions, and that wasn't really thought about from a legislative level, from my experience. So some of the women that maybe would have been housed at that time, their needs weren't met, and so they became homeless once again. Because they're not gender responsive, and the way that they frame legislation, things like that, isn't inclusive.
Okay, so it seems like sex workers, especially female street sex workers, weren't prioritised in the COVID-19 response to homelessness and hardship, and therefore continued to work. I was wondering if there were any provisions made on a more individual level to try and make their work any safer.
I'm aware of one clinical consultation where a nurse did talk to a sex worker about trying to stay safer during COVID, because as Carrie said, they've often got much more concerning priorities, let's say. The nurse did talk to her about maybe things that she could do that could kind of protect her partially from COVID, like mask wearing, wearing gloves, such activities that weren't perhaps as close contact.
That off-street project was kind of sharing infographics around that kind of stuff that Jude's talking about, and we did have provisions to hand out hand gels and masks and gloves and stuff like that as well. But obviously we're not sure about what choices people might have made or not made.
The next thing I was keen to get Caris's and Jude's insight on was the provision of and uptake of the COVID-19 vaccine among sex workers.
I think that's a local area issue, so everywhere will be completely different. But I think in Nottingham we've done really well.
Yeah, I think there is an organisation called Community Cohesion. They've coordinated some vaccine buses that have gone out to areas where there's been a low uptake of the COVID vaccine. So it hasn't particularly been around helping sex workers per se, but certainly gone into some of those areas where they are likely to be living and working. Did the vaccine bus come to POW?
Been here four times actually. So they came with a Pfizer vaccine one week, and the next week they came with some AstraZeneca, because we had some people that were the wrong age bracket for the Pfizer. So yeah, so it has been here. So public health have been interested in Nottingham around working with sex workers and vulnerable groups. So that's why I say I think the response locally has been very good. And they're working a lot around how to reach homeless populations and that have got health issues. But that's a local thing. That's not a national thing at all.
And we've sort of had a directive to try and talk to clients that come into sexual health services about the benefits of vaccine uptake. But obviously our uptake of services at the moment from sex workers is fairly low due to COVID.
I was keen to explore the provision of services to sex workers during the pandemic further, and I asked Jude how COVID-19 had affected the ability of her sexual health outreach team to provide sex workers with sexual health services.
Prior to the first lockdown, we worked quite intensively with POW, really, didn't we? So we supported a migrant sex workers clinic, which was held on site at POW. I think, was that every fortnight, Caris?
Yeah, on a Monday, wasn't it?
So that was on site at POW, and POW employ a migrant outreach worker who also speaks Romanian, because a lot of the migrant sex workers in Nottingham were Romanian. So that ceased right at the beginning of the pandemic, and we haven't been able to reinstate that yet. We also went out with POW staff to off-site premises, so into people's houses, flats and saunas or massage parlours, and all of that has ceased. We had a weekly on-site clinic at POW, which was a drop-in and coincided with the drug service and the homeless service. So, POW offered a kind of holistic kind of drop-in on that day, and that again ceased at the beginning of the pandemic and has not resumed yet. We were able to offer sexual health centres, but the uptake for that has been low. We knew it would be low, and that's why we have an outreach clinic at POW, because the sex workers are comfortable to access POW, and they access POW for lots of other reasons, whether it's those other services that are in there on the day, It might be just to come in and have a chat with other people. It might be for some welfare or benefits support, homelessness, the drug service, food, laundrette, or just to come and have a chat. So, you know, we've always seen people at the clinic when it's based in Pau. So we do see sex workers within our service, but that most vulnerable group, as Caris has described, the homeless, kind of drug using street workers, who were really the ones that we need to see the most, and because of their chaotic lifestyles in terms of STIs and unplanned pregnancy, we're not seeing very many of them at all, and I don't think we will until we're able to resume on-site provision.
I suppose that's not to say just because you're not seeing them that all those problems have gone away, is it?
No, not at all. And we are aware, you know, that there's been pregnancies which, you know, we can't say for definite we may have prevented. But I think had we been at PAL and seen people on a more regular basis, we were obviously much more aware of what was going on in people's lives. We could get people back in for their contraception and to talk to them. And we've kind of missed out on all of that, really.
I was curious to compare the provision of the NHS sexual health services during the pandemic with the provision of broader support services offered by PAL, and asked Caris if PAL's work had been able to continue.
Yeah, it's been obviously a movable feast, really, with the guidance and whether we can open or not. We've not opened our building for services to come in since the start of the pandemic, but we have been seeing people on the driveway since summer last year. So we hold a drop-in on the driveway instead, so people can come and get generally what they'd get from the drop-in anyway, apart from the social aspect people miss. The drugs clinic's been intermittent because of guidance and whether people could actually do their clinics. It's back on site now. So we're running that at the very start of the pandemic. I know, you know, NHS staffing is NHS staffing, isn't it? And it's had a massive toll on NHS frontline staff. So understandably, that service is not here at the moment. We got some self-testing kits and were able to do sexual health testing for people. Obviously, we've got the Glasshouse Street Clinic, or the off-site clinic that Drew's talking about as well, that people can go to. So we've tried to kind of bridge a bit of a gap, but we know without the nurses being on site, it's not the same.
I was just wondering if either of you would say that there's been any positives from the way that you've had to adapt your services due to the pandemic.
I think from PAL, we've seen loads of positives, actually. Not with regard to sexual health, because obviously we great the way it was. Being able to go out maybe more flexibly to do things has been helpful. I think for PAL, we didn't think we could ever work from home. At the very start of the pandemic, we had to work from home. So out of necessity, we had to adapt. It worked all right. We managed to alleviate crises and do all sorts of work without even seeing people. So we managed it and we continue to manage it. And now we take a more assertive approach to going out to people rather than just waiting for people to come here. So our drop-in hours are reduced, but our hours spent out doing meaningful stuff with people one-to-one has increased.
Okay, and do you think that's something that you'll continue after the pandemic?
Definitely, yeah. I think it's been a more productive way of working, and hopefully, you know, it helps people in a more tangible way.
What about you, Jude?
From my point of view, our relationship with PAL, no, it's all negative because we're not back yet. So I suppose from an NHS perspective, even though the restrictions have been eased, because the hospitals are full, because of the cases of COVID, because, you know, at the beginning of the pandemic, some of our staff were redeployed. Some of them had to go into ICU. So our overall sexual health provision was hugely impacted and reduced. We've also been providing COVID testing for NHS staff and people who, you know, pre-surgery. So we're still providing some of that service. And we're providing the results management for that as well. So it's had a massive impact on our service, but a really huge impact on outreach. I think for me, in relation to sex work and our relationship with PAL, I don't think there's anything positive that's come out of it for us. We want to be back. We want to get in there, but we're not going to be able to do that until the, you know, COVID cases are coming down. We still have staff off ourselves, staff that are isolating, so struggling to even provide the clinical services in some of our main clinics at the moment. It's just felt like a very, very, very long time.
And I think there's, you know, the longer things go on as a direct result of the pandemic, as with other clinical services, there's lots of harm going on and there's lots of cumulative harm that's going to, but I've got no doubt when we start doing more intensive testing once Jude and everyone's back, that we'll uncover lots of stuff that, you know, can be having quite severe consequences on people's physical health.
And I think as well, it's being based in PAL, even if people weren't specifically coming to our clinical staff for something around sexual health, the staff will get to know the clients, build up relationships. And as Carrie said, there would be other issues that would be kind of discussed or exposed, if you like, and that partnership working of working together holistically, safeguarding the clients and their children. We've kind of lost that contact, really, and that relationship stuff is the most important thing.
I think on like the one end of the spectrum, you know, you've got women that have suffered sexual violence during the pandemic who still haven't had real medical attention because of their lifestyle and how they live. And actually, if we had the services as normal and if there was no pandemic, they probably would have received some medical care from here through the team. You know, it could be outstanding even from over a year ago that they've not been seen.
And we also lost another service during the pandemic, which was called PAUSE, which worked closely with POW, and that was a kind of intensive intervention service that worked with women who had had multiple children removed. And our link with that was around providing long-term acting reversible contraception. And they had to commit to that for 18 months, which is why it was called PAUSE. So it's kind of trying to break that cycle of repeat unplanned pregnancies so that those women could have a kind of gap and time out to explore, reflect, you know, therapeutic services. And some of those clients were from POW, weren't they, Caris? And I just think it's such a shame that we've lost that service, which was part of a national programme that was working really, really well.
And now there's nothing for those women, you know, within the area to help with that. And POW are often left with that mother that's just had a baby removed because there's no other services. And PAUSE was fantastic for that and, you know, really unique. So it's a real loss to not have it.
I found it interesting that Jude's NHS Run outreach service had been redeployed to facilitate elective surgery during the pandemic. It struck me that a decision must have been made centrally to prioritise the needs of those having surgery over the needs of sex workers. I wonder whether this was a well-considered decision or reflects the fact that due to stigma and vulnerability, sex workers' needs are often less vocalised and more commonly hidden from wider society. The next thing I wanted to explore was an issue raised by B. Piper, that the COVID-19 lockdowns and restrictions inadvertently provided a practice run of what it would be like if sex work was governed under the so-called Nordic model in the UK. As a reminder, under the Nordic model, purchase of sex and the involvement of third parties, such as managers or pimps, is criminalised, but selling sex is not. This legal regime is often criticised by sex workers because it can be seen to shift the power dynamic between the sex worker and the client to favour the client. Molly Smith and Juno Mack describe this in their book Revolting Prostitutes. Think of a woman working on the street. She might have expected to see 3 or 4 clients in a couple of hours. But with her clients now criminalised, the stroll is quieter. Now suppose someone then approaches her, someone who seemed coked up or aggressive, or who was driving a car with a number plate she was warned by other workers to avoid. She still needs to earn enough money to put food on the table. Her lack of clients so far gives her less power to refuse a man she might otherwise turn down. During the pandemic, social distancing laws and stay-at-home orders reduced the number of clients willing to risk sanctions if caught visiting sex workers, effectively replicating the above scenario. I asked Caris if this was something that had been a problem at POW Nottingham.
I think some of the negative impacts of the Nordic model were felt, such as clients having more power. Because obviously the women, you know, it's legal for the women to be working in certain circumstances, so they would be, but because of the lockdown, they weren't, because no indoor work and seeing people was legal. So in that respect, we definitely saw that the clients had more power in bargaining and in what they were demanding. And so the women were more at risk and more vulnerable. But there was nothing kind of police-wise. But I think definitely some of the Nordic model negatives were seen. There were a lot of risks that people were exposed to, and they were more vulnerable to clients. And, you know, pricing was an issue. But that was what we found with migrant off-street women, not so much the street sex workers. That's not to say it doesn't happen.
So would you say that migrant sex workers were particularly negatively affected?
I think it's been challenging for migrant sex workers because they often might not be registered with certain things. They're not entitled to benefits and things like that necessarily. So actually they can't choose to take time off like some of the off-street women did and had savings and things like that. So out of necessity, they had to kind of take more risks. I know that certainly the use of contraception wasn't at normal levels because people were paying more for unprotected sex and things like that. So they were exposed to a lot more risk.
Another thing I was hoping to discuss with you both was the sort of lack of financial support for sex workers in particular during the pandemic, because obviously the government had the widespread furlough scheme for lots of other types of workers, which, due to the nature of sex work, sex workers weren't necessarily eligible for. Did you see sex workers getting any sort of financial support, or were you able to provide them with anything like that?
Women that were registered self-employed, of which we've got quite a few, were obviously able to access schemes for self-employed individuals. Other than that, people were claiming benefits as normal for furlough for people that weren't registered as self-employed. There wasn't anything for them, really. There was the SWARM hardship fund that was for sex workers. That's obviously nothing to do with the government, but we supported lots of women to go to that hardship fund to get money as and when needed.
The SWARM hardship or mutual aid fund was set up by SWARM, the Sex Worker Advocacy and Resistance Movement, on the 13th of March in 2020 to support the most marginalised and vulnerable sex workers in their community from the economic hardship of COVID-19. The majority of the money for the hardship fund came from private, individual donations or from small fundraising projects.
And other than that, we as an organisation applied for, I don't know if it was central government funding, but certainly local council funding for COVID hardship. That wasn't to hand out funds, but it was for basic essentials. So we kind of ran a little food bank, which we wouldn't do in normal times, and were able to get essentials out to people. Aside from that, we got the NUM voucher scheme as well to help people with supermarket shopping. That was a really great scheme, but all of these things that help generally are by organisations or from individuals, they're not from central government.
This information from Caris echoes Bea Piper's experience that the organisations and collectives providing the most meaningful and practical support for sex workers during the pandemic were either run by sex workers themselves or by groups working very closely with them. This made me appreciate why Bea emphasised in the last episode of this podcast that sex worker activists are pushing for sex workers themselves to be involved in legislation and policy decision making. A topic that commonly arises in the debate around sex work is whether sex work is real work. Sex workers' organisations, such as SWARM, advocate that sex work should be viewed as just another type of work, but this is often met with opposition. I was wondering if you felt this reluctance to view sex work as work has been part of the reason that sex workers have not received the same support as other workers during the pandemic.
I don't know, it's a tough one. Like I say, if people are registered self-employed as an adult entertainer, sex work industry, then they're eligible for everything that everyone else is.
Yeah.
So in that respect, there is an element that it is work, and actually it is recognised work in that way, but only if it's under that umbrella that the government deem it as. Street sex work is not recognised at all. Other things are not recognised, and I think because it's stigmatised in society, people don't necessarily feel comfortable to have it down as their job title.
And do you think that people who do have it down as their job title and are registered as self-employed are negatively affected by the stigma and public opinion, or do you think that the fact that they might then be able to access the economic support is better for them?
That's probably an individual thing. I can't say how everyone feels. I know certainly anything from negative impacted to doesn't impact at all, really. So I think some of those questions I think need to come from sex workers
Yeah, of course. They're the people who are living that experience are the only ones that can really provide the insight, isn't it?
One of the final issues I wanted Caris and Jude's perspective on was the call for the decriminalisation of sex work and the commonly given objection to this, that decriminalisation should not be allowed because sex work is harmful.
Our stance is quite clear around that, in that we support decrim quite strongly. Mm-hmm. And with regards to the sex work being harmful, I think a lot of the issues around it being harmful are because of systemic issues of stigma. And the policing and how unsafe it has to be because it's illegal. Actually, the most safe option, which is what we support, is decrim. So it would be least harmful to have that model, which is why we back it.
I think I would agree. I mean, it's interesting because Caris is aware. I did some research about 30 years ago and visited the ECP, and we're still having the same discussions. You know, a lot of it, I think, is around stigma, the hierarchy within the sex industry itself, with those street workers being the most vulnerable. And again, as Caris has said, everything that is around that, because of issues of legality or illegality, you know, it's so stigmatised and makes it incredibly difficult for people to access services and help. And if it wasn't for POW, I'm not sure that they would. POW is the kind of centre where they can go for everything to, you know, and if POW can't provide it, they'll find who can. And I think, you know, it's a really, really important service, but without it, I think a lot of those people would be even more vulnerable and not known to services and just operate completely underground, really.
I was just wondering if you think that there was anything that could have been done differently that might have mitigated some of the negative effects that the pandemic has had on sex workers.
I think it's quite difficult living in the reality of the society that we live in, to be honest. So in a different society that was more gender inclusive and, you know, didn't stigmatise and have all the harms that it does have, yeah, things could have been done, you know, not even just gender inclusive because, you know, sex workers are from all genders.
Yeah.
But thinking about the everyone in scheme with homelessness and people trying to combat that, that wasn't, you know, expressly interested in gendered responses. That could have been different.
I'm just interrupting to explain that the everyone in scheme that Caris is referring to was the government run programme to provide hotel and emergency accommodation for the homeless during the pandemic. £3.2 million were invested in this scheme, and the government asked local councils to help get everybody in accommodation. This included housing people who would not usually have been entitled to support under the pre-pandemic existing homelessness legislation. However, as Caris highlights, the scheme did not necessarily make provisions for the so-called hidden homeless. This meant women, often sex workers, who were not visibly rough sleepers, were not necessarily housed. Also, those with no recourse to public funds, that is, the migrants we have heard about, were also excluded. This further exacerbated the hardships that we have heard they faced during the pandemic.
Yeah, I agree. I think there's a kind of social view of the deserving and the undeserving poor. And I think particularly street sex workers are regarded as the undeserving poor. I have heard comments from senior people, naming no names, who have described the sex workers at POW as kind of feral, you know, really derogatory terms. So I think from several central government to local government, there needs to be a shift.
So, yeah, thank you both so much for talking to me. It's been really, really insightful and really helpful. The last thing I was going to ask Caris is, if people wanted to support POW or find out more information, what would be the best way to do that?
Yeah, so follow us on social media. We're on every platform. We've got our website, pow-advice.co.uk, that you can check out. We've got an Amazon wish list and we have Just Giving pages if people want to give a one-off donation or give a monthly donation to us. It all goes to helping sex workers. We don't have many overheads as a small charity. So any help is great.
A huge thank you to Jude and Caris for joining me today and providing us with such a great insight into the work that they do. I will link Pal's website to the podcast for everyone to access if they're interested. Thank you for listening, and I'll see you next time.
The Idea Pod is produced by the Interdisciplinary Ethics Applied Centre at the University of Leeds. Find out more at ahc.leeds.ac.uk/ethics. Music composed and conducted by Josh Armitage.